Now, for for and against from friends and foes, but bearing in mind that Iran did comply with the JCPOA terms until it found itself unsupported by the West, hence all the trouble that ensued. Saudi Arabia, Iran's regional rival, welcomes IAEA's resolution on Iran, according to Arab News. Saudi Arabia called on this country to cooperate with the IAEA and resolve outstanding issues without delay, stressing that Iran must comply with its obligations under the Safeguards Agreement, given the necessity to cooperate with the agency to resolve all outstanding nuclear issues. The IAEA said Wednesday it had adopted a resolution formally criticizing Iran for a lack of cooperation with the UN Nuclear Inspectorate, diplomatic sources told AFP, but this motion is the first to criticize Iran since June 2020 and comes amidst an impasse on efforts to bring the US back into the 2015 deal over Iran's nuclear program. As for what Russia has to say, Mir News reads, Russia envoy ridicules anti-Iran's stupid resolution at IAEA, in quotes. Russia's envoy to international organizations based in Vienna has once again criticized the passing of an anti-Iran resolution. Russia's permanent representative being Mikhail Ulyanov, he wrote in a tweet that, have you got the latest news from hashtag Iran? Do you understand now why Russia voted against the stupid Western resolution of the hashtag IAEA Board of Governors on Iran yesterday? Regrettably, our Western counterparts demonstrate a total lack of understanding of where we are. Russia and China voted against the Western-drafted anti-Tehran resolution at the IAEA's Board of Governors Wednesday. That would be it for the news section. Do stay tuned. Question is, how many inspections is the agency doing in that country, the Zionist entity, that is? Is it even allowed to have an inspection there? Israel, which hates the JCPOA and is the only possessor of nuclear weapons in the region. Do comment on Grossi's trip to Israel. Isn't it a little bit weird? I mean, if we are talking nuclear justice here, Israel has up to 400 nuclear warheads in this region.
Israel, that possesses numerous nuclear warheads, hosted Mr. Grossi. This was a politically motivated move to put pressure on Iran. It is very clear that this visit was directly related to Iran's nuclear case, and it is sad to say that, like always, Israel is playing a role in the decision of the IAEA Board of Governors against Iran.
Grossi's visit to Tel Aviv at this delicate time when all parties are trying to revive the JCPOA has created critical responses among many political experts.
So what happened? How come the Israelis are happy? Basically, we believe that the IAEA is unfortunately spying for the US and Israel. However, some of the member countries have acted in a positive and brave way. What I mean is the current policy of the IAEA and the Director General. The decisions made in the agency and the acts are all in favor of the US and its allies and their mischievous plans against Iran.
The fact that there has never been an inspection of the Israeli nuclear facilities by the IAEA is common knowledge among international experts. In fact, there has never been one single clear and transparent statistic of the Israeli nuclear arsenal. Yet, the Zionist regime allows itself to accuse Iran of misleading the world with lies and false information. Washington has acknowledged for months that there will come a point when the deal's non-proliferation benefits become moot because Tehran is gaining irreversible nuclear knowledge and fast approaching nuclear threshold status. But for now, the push to revive the 2015 nuclear deal seems to have stalled over the U.S. designation of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, IRGC, as a foreign terrorist organization. With Washington reluctant to meet Tehran's demand of removing the group from the blacklist to seal the deal. In this regard, a source close to the Islamic Republic's diplomatic apparatus said if E3 stopped acting as accessories to the US and the Zionist regime at the negotiating table and also quit their futile blame game and instead genuinely focused on resolving the issues, a revival of the nuclear deal is actually possible. But the diplomat underlined the fact that Britain, France and Germany have rather failed to even fulfill their own JCPOA commitments due to total impotence in resisting the US bullying behind the facade and seem to be absolutely powerless against the US coercion.
We have seen that the three European countries that were supposed to convince the United States to lift its sanctions on Iran sponsored an anti-Iran resolution at the IAEA Board of Governors. On the other hand, Mr. Grossi, who is expected to block unpeaceful nuclear activities, pays a visit to Israel. Israel has never joined the NPT and possesses nuclear warheads.
That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do return to the box at the same times next week and each week off. Bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Republicans loyal to former President Donald Trump mounted a desperate rearguard action on Monday, 13th of June, to counter the devastating narrative of Congress's latest January 6th hearing. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist David Smith. The piece is titled, Trump Loyalists Push Desperate Counter-Narrative to Combat Damaging January 6 Testimony. In the United States, Republicans loyal to former President Donald Trump mounted a desperate rearguard action on Monday, 13th of June, to counter the devastating narrative of Congress's latest January 6 hearing. A House of Representatives panel investigating the insurrection on 6th of January used testimony from Donald Trump's own attorney general and campaign manager to assert that the former president knowingly propagated the big lie of a stolen election with deadly consequences. But even as the hearing unfolded on live television, leading Republicans defiantly pushed a counter-narrative that claims the committee is illegitimate, politically motivated, and out of touch with the Americans' everyday lives. The whole thing is an absurdity designed by desperate Democrats to try to help them this fall and to try to weaken Trump if he should run again in 2024. Newt Gingrich, a former House Speaker, told The Guardian. Newt Gingrich added, "So I don't pay any attention to it." Gingrich described the hearings as a Stalinist show trial that have nothing to do with fairness or finding the truth. On Monday, 13th of June, the House committee made the case that Donald Trump and his advisers knew that his claims of fraud in the 2020 election were false. It played video clips in which Donald Trump's former campaign manager Bill Stepien told investigators that lawyer Rudy Giuliani was urging Donald Trump to declare victory on election night, despite Bill Stepien's warnings that it was way too early to make such a prediction. Distancing himself from the wild conspiracy theories, Bill Stepien said, "I didn't mind being categorized. There were two groups of them. We called them kind of my team and Rudy Giuliani's team. I didn't mind being categorized as team normal." But Republican leaders in the House tweeted a very different set of messages during the hearing. One even sought to deflect attention to Democrats' supposed fixation on woke cultural issues, such as transgender rights. Jim Jordan, the top Republican in the House Judiciary Committee, posted, the same party that has mismanaged the economy wants you to trust them as the January 6th committee. Others cited the decision by the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to exclude Jim Jordan and colleague Jim Banks, both of whom backed Donald Trump's effort to overturn the election, as evidence that the committee is one-sided and lacks credibility. Elise Stefanik, chair of the House Republican Conference, wrote on Twitter, "Lame duck Speaker Nancy Pelosi's select committee is illegitimate. Its purpose is to distract the American people from the fact that House Democrats have no agenda for Americans and no real solutions to the problems that we face on a daily basis." In more video testimony shown at the hearing, former Attorney General William Barr dismissed Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud as crazy stuff and complete nonsense. A Twitter account known as Trump War Room, run by his political action committee, Save America, sought to challenge these assertions. It posted, "Flashback, William Barr admits mail-in ballots have been found to have substantial fraud. Elections that have been held with mail have found substantial fraud." Republican Twitter accounts also deployed the tried and trusted tactic of whataboutism, claiming that Democrats have also frequently questioned the legitimacy of elections, though none has instigated an insurrection. Trump War Room posted, "Remember when Hillary Clinton claimed President Trump's election was illegitimate?" The Republican National Committee research posted, "In 2017, Democrat Benny Thompson, chair of Nancy Pelosi's illegitimate committee, refused to attend President Trump's inauguration because he questioned the legitimacy of the 2016 presidential election." The hearing was again broadcast on major nonpartisan television networks, making it hard for Republicans to ignore. Trump diehards are unlikely to be moved, but the damning evidence could cut through and persuade some moderate and independent voters of his culpability. Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal ran an opinion column over the weekend that concluded, "Donald Trump betrayed his supporters by conning them on 6th of January 2021, and he's still doing it." Rupert Murdoch's New York Post encouraged readers to move on from Trump, telling them to unsubscribe from Donald Trump's daily emails begging for money and to pick your favorite from a new crop of conservatives. But another glimpse into the Republican psyche was offered by Fox News Channel, which, having refused to broadcast Thursday's first hearing during primetime, did provide live coverage of the second during daytime. Its panel of experts gave the session a distinctly lukewarm reception. Martha McCallum, a Fox News host, pivoted to politics. "You have former President Donald Trump, who is obviously the focus of this, tying him to these events, and we'll see the effort to do that throughout the course of the next hearings. And then you have all these stories this morning about Democrats saying that they think that President Biden is the anchor that needs to be cut loose. So you're looking at two individuals who are the most likely clear next runners for the presidential election, and there's just a lot of questions all across the board." Then Jonathan Turley, a legal analyst, said he was unsure what case the committee was making and argued it would have greater weight if more Republicans were involved in the committee. He commented, "You can say this in laying a foundation for what they said they would be proving, which is an attempted coup. That's a tall order." But so far, they seem to be trying to sort of create a persona non grata trial to declare former President Trump a horrible person, and they may not get much pushback at the end of the hearing. "I thought the most telling moment came at the end of when the chairman said, I'm going to introduce this video unless there is an objection, and that really put a pin on it. It's like asking at a wedding, anyone who objects to this union, speak up. Nobody is really there to do it. Andy McCarthy, an author and lawyer, also challenged the process. They've got a very good story to tell. The problem is they've set it up in a process that is not a fair process, that's aimed at getting to the truth and giving whatever contra-arguments there are their day in court. And as a result, it's more like messaging than it is like a real investigation. I could have been very impressive in court if there were no defense lawyers, you know. But America's new agenda is likely to be dominated by clips of William Barr and others. The former Attorney General, William Barr, delivered some memorable lines, telling investigators at one point that Donald Trump had become detached from reality if he really believed his stuff.
We say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Come here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Thousands of people are protesting for and against a leaked draft decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. The so-called pro-life and pro-choice movements in America are once again at each other's throats. 450 protests were set to be held all over the country, including the capital, Washington, D.C., New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, demanding that the Supreme Court not take away the right to abortion. Justice Clarence Thomas says the leak of the draft destroyed trust among the members of the Supreme Court. It seems that Americans found another excuse to show their division, disunity, and hatred. The two sides are extremely divided, but very much united in their division.
Pro-division.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And in this episode, we'll discuss a Supreme Court draft decision leak, the subject of abortion, and how differences on the topic has caused another divide in America. We'll shed some light on the protests and violence that has occurred as a result of the leak, and also we'll see if the Supreme Court can keep its position as a judge and referee, or will its decisions be partisan and compromised? And as usual, we're pleased to have our two guests on our show, Thomas Michalek, political analyst from Michigan, and Natalie Kai, who's an analyst out of Baltimore, Maryland. Stay tuned.
A draft of the majority Supreme Court decision in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization has been recently leaked to the public. Based on the draft, the Supreme Court will overrule the 1973 Roe v. Wade and the 1992 Parenthood v. Casey decisions.
Now, the court in 1973 ruled that the Constitution of the United States protects a pregnant woman's liberty to choose to have an abortion without excessive government restriction. So when the final decision is issued, the guaranteed right to abortion in America will not be federally recognized for a first time in almost 50 years. So what is the status of abortion in the country in light of the leaked court decision?
Well, the Supreme Court decision of Roe versus Wade is the decision that allows on a federal level, or it's the decision that makes it so individual states cannot infringe on the decision of a woman to terminate a pregnancy. And naturally, with other things, it's extremely political. People are very upset. A lot of people are, not everybody. You have demonstrations and so on that are occurring in various places. Usually it's more liberal led demonstrations. And people who are in favor of the. Well, see, here's the thing. The way people are taking it is as if Roe v. Wade has already been overturned, which is not the case. It was, of course, a leaked draft decision that. So as of right now, it's, nothing has changed, but with a lot of things in American politics, often rumors or things that are going to happen, people imagine that they already have happened. So you will probably, if you would encounter people who believe right now that now abortion is illegal. Even, you know, it's unfortunate. There are a lot of people in states that would not infringe on the current legal status of abortions. I'm sure there are a lot of people who believe, as of right now, that even in their state, abortion is illegal.
Thousands of protesters have gathered in cities across the U.S. chanting against the draft Supreme Court decision and in favor of abortion rights. A lawyer from Virginia participating in protests in Washington, D.C. has said, quote unquote, "We did our best to elect a Democratic president and House and Senate, and this is still happening." Comments like this shows how divisions between political parties and dissatisfaction with the administration are becoming very severe. So what is the situation in America after the leak of the Supreme Court decision?
So recently, the Supreme Court released a draft opinion on Roe v. Wade. The majority opinion was written by Justice Alito. A certain population of the American citizens are upset by this opinion because they view this opinion, which, you know, it reverses Roe v. Wade, and Roe v. Wade serves as a precedent for many other cases like Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And they see this opinion, this draft opinion, as a reversal of a fundamental right. And so they're protesting it.
Political analysts fear there will be violence due to the decision of the Supreme Court, especially when they make the final decision in the summer. There has been many violent incidents, both from pro- and anti-abortion activists against each other. Recently, a so-called pro-choice group threw a Molotov cocktail into the window of the headquarters of an anti-abortion group called Wisconsin Family Action in Madison, causing a fire.
I think pro-life and pro-choice protesters will directly confront each other. But there certainly will be violence on, coming from the pro-choice side. As I've said before, there have been Catholic churches and crisis pregnancy centers who have been met with violence and vandalism. For example, a mass in California, in Los Angeles, was interrupted by pro-choice protesters with red robes and white caps. And a church in Lower Manhattan was threatened with bombs. And, you know, and pro-choice protesters threatened that they would burn their church down. Now, obviously, this doesn't represent all pro-choice protesters, but a certain violent segment of them.
In early May, the two opposing groups gathered and shouted slogans at each other from across the street in Boston. The scene turned violent when one of the pro-choice rally protesters ran across the street and attacked a speaker from the pro-life protest, trying to hit him in the head with a bike lock. Throughout the years, several clinical doctors that perform abortions have been murdered. Many from both anti- and pro-abortion groups have received death threats and have been subjected to violence.
Justice Clarence Thomas said at a conference in Dallas, Texas, that the leak of the draft opinion has done irreparable damage to the Supreme Court and likened it to infidelity. Now, Thomas said that this had destroyed trust among its members. He also denounced recent protests that took place at justices' homes and added that conservatives will not adopt such tactics, displaying the differences in political rift between the two major American parties.
It's actually amazing. Even right before I got on this interview, I was just having a conversation with someone who I met in public just about... It's weird. You can't actually even discuss the issues with a lot of people unless there's like a presumptive, you already agree with me, and if you don't, you're my opponent. And I had just a nasty encounter with a stranger when I didn't even give my views on the subject at all, just that I'm about to discuss the issue. And I didn't make it clear from the beginning with this person that, you know, I'm one way or the other. It's extremely divisive. It's a culture issue that is designed on purpose to sow divisions between people.
There has been a drop in the rate of abortion in the United States since a decade ago. According to the Guttmacher Institute, which is a research and policy organization and an advocate of abortion rights in the world, restrictions of abortion were not the key cause of this decline in the U.S. between 2011 and 2017. The decline in abortion seems to be linked to the declines in the overall birth and pregnancies. Still, the CDC reported close to 630,000 legal-induced abortions in 2019. How do you think the Supreme Court decision will affect the elections?
A lot to do with the upcoming elections. As we all know, the Democratic Party at this point is not offering any program to the millions of suffering people in this country. They're offering nothing to make anyone's life any better. So ultimately what they rest on are contentious social issues. And this is something that they've been animated, both sides have been animating their respective voter bases to be energized for elections on this basis for a very long time. I wouldn't be surprised if the tone of the upcoming elections is based on this particular issue and not matters that inflation, war, these other matters that are more something that the rulers of this country would prefer people avoid talking about. This is a totally suitable substitute in their mind.
Public opinion in the U.S. remains very divided on the issue of abortion. A survey from May 2021 found 49% of Americans consider themselves pro-choice and 47% pro-life. Now, the same survey found the population that were more likely to support making abortion legal under any circumstance were younger adults. According to Pew Research, public attitudes about the legality of abortion are largely divided along partisan lines and to a greater extent than in past decades.
This increasing division has always been in American politics, and I think the way that the American political system was set up was built to create division. But I do think that the media does play an important role in helping to increase the political divisions. The American media is mostly based off of corporations, and corporations obviously need to make money. And they make money through sensationalist topics and articles. And, you know, this helps, you know, get in more readers and more ad revenue. So I think, you know, obviously corporate media have something to do with the divisions. And I think it's just a way to, you know, distract the American working class from more important issues. You know, these social issues like abortion, you know, while they are important, they are a distraction from more important issues like healthcare and workers' rights and, you know, just getting American troops out of foreign countries.
Even though the subject of abortion has for a long time divided political partisans, the partisan gap is now much wider than it ever was. While 80% of Democrats or Democratic-leaning independents believe that abortion should be legal in all or most cases, only 35% of Republicans and Republican leaners believe the same. This is while in 2007, only 63% of Democrats and 39% of Republicans believed that abortion should be legal in all or most cases.
The Democrats have been trying to, in the wake of the the release of the draft. They have been trying to codify abortion into law through Congress. An act called the Women's Health Protection Act. It was proposed in the Senate, but it was but it didn't pass. By a 49-51 vote. And so I guess you could say that the Democrats have been trying to, bypass this decision through codifying abortion into law.
In Louisiana, women gathered on the state capitol steps to oppose abortion rights. The crowd were hopeful that the Supreme Court will in fact overturn Roe v. Wade and now recognize a federal right of abortion. All five women in the Louisiana Senate, which consists of three Republicans and two Democrats, oppose abortion. Voters in the state overwhelmingly approved an amendment to the Louisiana Constitution declaring there is no right to and no funding for abortion.
Well, the protests aren't so big at this point. I mean, they exist, but it's not on the level of, say, the George Floyd demonstrations of summer 2020, where it's something that is inescapable. So at this point, it's fairly mild. But, for example, in the state that I live in, of Michigan, the attorney general has said that she will not enforce, in the event that Roe v. Wade is overturned, Michigan has a state from 1931 that would outlaw abortions. She is saying that she would not enforce those laws. So, it's causing a lot of panic among a lot of people. But I imagine that you'd see some states making legislation that does affirm explicitly the legal status of abortions. There are states that have what are referred to commonly as trigger laws, meaning in the event that Roe v. Wade is overturned, immediately, like in an instant, the abortions would be made illegal. In Michigan, in such a state, the 1931 law still being on the books.
The subject of abortion is such a divisive topic in America that it has led to many events of violence. From 1970 to 2018, there has been at least 258 abortion-related terrorist attacks in the country, which makes abortion-related facilities the fourth most common target of terror attacks in the United States during that period. So how will the court decision affect minorities?
Know exactly how this will impact minorities, and I think it's too soon to say how this opinion will impact minorities. Obviously, it's only a draft opinion, and we'll know what will happen in a few months when the final, decision is released. The pro-choice side will see it as an affront to minority rights because they somehow view abortion as fundamental to the rights of minorities. However, the history of abortion is a very racist one. And, you know, if you know anything about Planned Parenthood, they have, you know, they engaged in very, very suspicious and sketchy campaigns in African countries. And, you know, the founder, Margaret Sanger, was a very racist person, and she was a eugenicist. So I think that, after this decision, there will have to be a greater focus on, just helping, minority women who are in desperate situations. And this is something that the pro-choice side thinks can be solved with abortion, but it can't.
The dispute over the right of abortion has been ongoing for decades, even though people and advocates of both sides give themselves catchy names such as pro-choice and pro-life. It seems they should be both called pro-divisive. The pro-choice movement only recognizes the choice of the mother, and father's opinion and the unborn baby's rights are largely ignored by this movement. Now, today, the divide is very real, and it seems that Americans use every avenue and excuse to express their hatred and intolerance towards one another, causing a huge rift among the people. And now let's see what Abbas Mortarim has prepared for us this week.
America, land of the free, home of the brave, claims to be a country that is united, but in reality, it's divided. And though it claims to be a now integrated country and a melting pot and that everyone has a chance at the so-called American dream, the truth of the matter is that America is still segregated, much like how it was during the Jim Crow era. On this episode of Power to the People, we're going to take a look at how America is a segregated, apartheid, settler colonial state. If we look at the settler colonial state of America, from its inception, it has been rooted in genocide and continues to practice genocide against Black and Indigenous people. Euro-Americans and Europeans stole Africans from Africa and then enslaved us in America, forcing Black people to build the wealth of this country. Post the so-called ending of slavery, and I say so-called because slavery has never ended as it was wittily legalized via the 13th Amendment, which says that slavery cannot be used unless punishment of a crime. And this essentially legalized the state to own slaves. And then even after the ending of slavery, chattel slavery still existed in areas in the Deep South well into the 1960s. Yet people want to act as if slavery is a thing of the past. At the end of the Civil War, after the ending of chattel slavery, segregation was created as a new development of the settler colonial system post the Civil War Reconstruction era that keeps new Africans oppressed. Almost immediately, Black people was put into chain gangs where Black people were chained together and forced to do free labor for the state. The state then created new racist laws, even more laws that would wittily lock up Black people for anything. Literally from using a water fountain to walking on the wrong side of the road to looking at a white woman the wrong way. And this is all part of the development of the Jim Crow South, which apartheid South Africa literally learned from. Jim Crow South, what it did is it legalized racist, segregationist laws and put them into every single aspect of society. One of these laws was Plessy versus Ferguson, which claimed that all of society must be separate versus equal, literally meaning that society must be segregated, but everything is supposed to be quote unquote equal, which we all know couldn't be further from the truth. As Black people is literally subjected to bad housing, neglected schools, bad jobs such as sharecropping, which literally replicated slavery, racist police, and a whole bunch more oppression. Literally every sector of life was segregated from bathrooms to water fountains to jobs to transportation. And once black people decided they had enough and fled the South to migrate north and to the West Coast in hopes for a better life, Black folks was literally met with a similar type of segregation to the Jim Crow South. This was created in part by a new evolution of segregation through redlining, which segregated neighborhoods, and Black people was now only allowed to live in areas that was marked red, which were neighborhoods in which all of the resources were taken out of. This was how America created the ghetto and continued segregation. Just like in the Jim Crow South, Black people in cities like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and Oakland were all subjected to bad housing, environmental racism, poor schools, jobs where exploitation was rampant, and a variety of other racist oppression. And today, society is just as segregated now, if not more, than it was during Jim Crow. Schools are literally just as segregated as they were pre-Brown versus Board. And in California, which people refer to as a progressive safe haven, in 2014, the state led the nation in children going to school with members of their own race, aka segregation. But it's a Democrat-ran state. And you know, when I was in university, the department that I graduated from, the political science department, it had yet to have a Black professor. And Black men are more disenfranchised than during Jim Crow. And more Black men are under correctional control than enslaved Africans were enslaved during chattel slavery. This has literally created a society that is based in apartheid, where the ruling white settler colonial class controls all of the land and economy. And now I just want to finish with five stats that show how segregated this apartheid settler colonial state is. For one, 96.1% of the 1.2 million households and the top 1% by income were white. America's 100 richest people control more wealth than the entire black population. And the five largest white landowners own more land than all black people combined. The average black family would need 228 years to build the wealth of a white family today. And that suggests that white people stopped making money and allowed black people to catch up. This American apartheid state, it violates all types of human rights. And apartheid, it must come to an end. And settler colonialism, it must come to an end as well. This is power to the people.
And that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And do join us again next time for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week we took up explanation of Surah Al-Waqiyah, that is, the imminent hour, or the inevitable event to occur at the end of time. It is the day of resurrection, followed by the final judgment, which the disbelievers deny. On the day of judgment, there will be sorting out of good and evil. People will be divided into three classes. Those brought near to the divine threshold for having reached the highest degree of faith, those on the right, or ordinary believers, who might have made mistakes, but turned in repentance to Allah and thereafter lived a pious life, and those on the left, that is, the disbelievers, who denied God's message and the prophets, lived in sins and died in the state of disbelief. Ample proof is given in this surah of the infinite power of the Almighty Creator, and consequently, his ability to bring about resurrection. If you might recall, last Friday, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of Surah Waqia, we said, paradise is for the persons of true belief, including those who had sincerely repented of their misdeeds and earned forgiveness from God, while hell is for the disbelievers, the heretics, the tyrants, the misleaders of people, and the unrepentant sinners. We also said that pride of place in the highest echelons of paradise is for the foremost in faith and deeds, some of whose rewards we have already recounted. And here, we present to you some more of their rewards as mentioned in Ayahs 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, and 26.
وفاكهة مما يتخيرون ولحم طير مما يشتهون وحور عين كأمثال اللؤلؤ المكنود جزاء بما كانوا يعملون لا يسمعون فيها لغوا ولا تأثيما إلا قيلا سلاما سلاما.
And such fruits as they prefer, and such flesh of foals as they desire, and big-eyed houris like guarded pearls, a reward for what they used to do. They will not hear therein any vain talk or words of ill will, but only the watchword, peace, peace. The foremost of the faithful are called Sabiqoon, and since on the Day of Judgment they will be nearest to God Almighty because of their degree of unblemished faith, they are referred to as Muqarrabun. This group comprises the prophets, the infallible imams, the saints, and those who strove relentlessly for the salvation of mankind and deliverance from darkness, even if this led to the loss of their own life and possessions. Thus, the Almighty rewards them with the highest echelons of paradise and its unimaginable bounties. These include, as is clear from the ayahs that we recited to you now, fruits that they prefer, the meat of fowls that they desire, and the company of houris, which, as we said last week, are species of heavenly females endowed with large, attractive eyes and are like pearls of transparent beauty, untouched and unseen by any others, except the one to whom they have been granted. These divine blessings are not because of no reason, but as rewards for their unfaltering belief without the least doubt and their constant doing of righteous good deeds. The important point to note here is that, since paradise is the abode of peace, sincerity, and serenity, the pleasures for its residents, whether spiritual or material, shall not be accompanied by the psychological pain of vain talk and words of resentment, but of expressions of perpetual peace and purity of intentions. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the bounties of paradise are beyond our imagination, and only a few glimpses of this perpetual state of bliss is provided here as rewards for firm faith and good deeds. while abstaining from anything or act that are considered unlawful and undesirable. Number two, paradise is the place of unspoiled purity and cleanliness, and thus the women therein are not just endowed with beauty, but also chastity to keep aloof from anyone except the lawful spouse. And number three, paradise is the place of perpetual peace and sincerity, where the expressions are of gratitude to God and His praise, undisturbed by any idle talk or words of grievance. Now let us listen to ayahs 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, and 37 of the same surah.
وَأَصْحَابُ الْيَمِينِ مَا أَصْحَابُ الْيَمِينِ فِي سِدْرٍ مَخْضُودٍ وَطَلْحٍ مَنْضُودٍ وظل ممدود وماء مسكوب وفاكهة كثيرة لا مقطوعة ولا ممنوعة وفرش مرفوعة إنا أنشأناهن إنشاء فجعلناهن أبكارا عربا أترابا لأصحاب اليمين.
And the people of the right hand? What or how fortunate are the people of the right hand? They shall reside amid thornless lotteries and clustered spathes of plantains and extended shade, and ever-flowing water, and abundant fruits, neither inaccessible nor forbidden, and noble spouses. We have created them with a special creation, and made them virgins, loving of a like age. After mentioning some of the rewards for the foremost of the faithful, these ayahs describe the blessings reserved for the second rank of believers, who are called Ahlul Yamin, or the people of the right, for being fortunate to receive the record of their brilliant deeds in the right hand with tidings to enter paradise. This group too, whether men or women, will enjoy various kinds of blessings as rewards for their degrees of faith and the good deeds they had done in the world. They will reside in gardens of shady trees, bearing all kinds of fruits, and devoid of any thorn, amidst an exquisite atmosphere of fresh flowing springs of water, surrounded by orchards of fruits available at all times. The virtuous men shall be granted spouses of immaculate characteristics that remain constantly fresh for them, with the essence of loyalty and no withering in age and beauty. As for the virtuous women of paradise, they have the option to be with their husbands and children, if these were virtuous as well, to deserve the blessings of heaven. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, unlike the pleasures of the mortal world, which are not always beneficial, and in case of being unlawful, may end in self-destruction, the bounties of paradise are devoid of any harm and always accessible without the least trouble. Number two, paradise is the place of exquisite beauty and blessings as rewards for those who were firm of faith and did righteous deeds, and in case of any fault or sins, earnestly turned to the all-merciful Lord in repentance for forgiveness. And number three, worldly marriages may end in death or separation, and at times divorce, but heavenly spouses are perfectly matched with each other on the basis of love and loyalty, without the least disassociation, distraction, or discord. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, here are ayahs 38, 39, and 40 of Surah Waqia.
عربا أترابا لأصحاب اليمين ثلة من الأولين وثلة من الآخرين.
For the people of the right hand, a multitude from the former generations, and a multitude from the latter ones. These ayahs that give tidings to the people of the right hand who will enter paradise mean to say that this group is not limited to any specific period of history, but are made up of virtuous believers of each and every generation, whether from the nations of the remote past or those to be born in the distant future. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, the path towards the bliss of paradise is open for all mankind, striving towards monotheism and virtue in every age and era and in all places around the world, irrespective of the superficial differences of ethnicity, color of skin, social class, and the language spoken. And number two, this is indeed the infinite mercy of the one and only creator of the universe, who has given ample opportunities and respite to the human beings to repent, reform, and rectify their wrongs, while abstaining from the satanic tendencies of sins, disbelief, atheism, polytheism, and the like.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The EU is Britain's largest trading partner by some distance, and the UK is the EU's third largest customer for goods. Therefore, there's a great deal to lose if relations continue to deteriorate.
This is illegal.
The 27-nation bloc is furious at plans by the British government to rip up the post-Brexit trade agreement relating to Northern Ireland agreed in 2020. Apparently, Boris Johnson's proposals would create a mountain of paperwork for businesses in Northern Ireland.
I mean, go and ask the milk producers in Northern Ireland, how he or she can produce the milk, one sort for EU, another one for the UK, or any kind of manufacturer who wants to benefit from the access to both markets of the UK and the EU.
Brussels is taking London to court for not fulfilling the terms of the so-called Northern Ireland Protocol. The mechanism is designed to prevent border checks between the North and the Republic of Ireland, thereby avoiding the potential for sectarian violence. The United States is siding with the EU on this issue, which means London has limited options when it comes to finding new, big trading partners. Currently,